This program is a paid presentation for American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC, and is brought to you by American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC. The opinions expressed on the program by the host, host guest, and call-in listeners are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not represent the opinions of management of this station or Brazos Communications West, LLC, who bear no responsibility or liability for the program's content. The purpose of this radio program is intended to inform the public on financial planning issues and investment products for qualified individuals and investors. Many of the topics and opinions discussed may be of a personal nature, and some people may disagree with or find opinions expressed on this program objectionable. Before you invest, you should consult with financial advisors and review the program prospectus and its risks.
97 Gold presents Your Money with Fay Bagby. Sound advice to help your money grow. Now, here's Fay Bagby on 97 Gold.
Good morning.
Well, good morning, Faye. How are you?
Well, I'm trying to get used to the cold weather. You know, I mean, it has definitely finally gotten cold, hasn't it? I mean, you know, these mornings of 23 degrees, you know, is a little cold.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you get the wind blowing on top of it. It's like, oh, Lord, that's even worse. Man.
Yeah, that 27-mile wind is too much for me.
It is. Not only will it blow you over, but it's the kind of wind that goes like right through, and you can feel the wind hitting your bones for some reason. It's like, but I've got skin.
That's exactly right. And you need a scarf around your neck. You need a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, when it's bad out.
Mm. Yeah. Scarf, mittens, hat, the whole works. You don't go outside with anything exposed. Man, that could be dangerous.
That's right. And you need to start your car from the house.
Yes.
Don't go out there and start it. Do it from the house and have it nice and toasty before you get out there.
Man, you remember the old days when you'd have to go out and start your car and then like turn on the defroster or the blower and then run back in for like 10 minutes and then look out every once in a while to make sure who was still in the driveway?
Yeah, I remember all that.
Yeah.
And I remember leaving lots of times and ice is still on the windshield and you're waiting for it to dissolve. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Man.
And cars have improved so much. It's a blessing, I can tell you.
They really have. We were talking to somebody the other day. We were out in some random person we don't even know just started talking, and we somehow got talking about cars and all the advancements. And I was telling him a little bit about, you know, some of the stories that you had told about your friend's recent experience. And he's like, wow. He's like, man, I can't even imagine some of the things that are in cars these days. We thought it was great when we finally had, like, seat warmers. That was a big deal. Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
It's like fancy.
Well, and it is. And now the steering wheels are all heated.
Oh, yes.
You know, used to, you know, the steering wheel was so cold in the mornings.
Yeah.
Now they're heated. Yeah. I mean, they've thought of every convenience.
They really have, you know.
And it really makes a difference in our lives for all this convenience.
Yes.
I don't know what we did back in the 60s and 70s when you know, you got in those cold cars, and you remember the seats were plastic back then. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Plastic seats. I remember that.
Oh.
And they were cold. Oh, my gosh, those plastic seats were cold.
Yes.
But they wanted to keep the seats covered, you know, like in a house, so they would put the plastic covers on there.
Yeah.
And my gosh, it was cold.
It was
and
so
And when you
cold.
Had to scoot across that thing, it was not funny.
Oh, no, it was not. And then in the summer with the plastic seats, if you were to wear shorts, you would like stick to the seat and then you'd have to pry yourself
That's
off.
That's exactly
of it.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And then before
and do
we.
Do you realize back then in the 60s, you had the option of not having an air conditioner in the car?
Yes. Yes.
Do you remember that?
I do. I had one.
You didn't have to have air conditioner. You could get a car without an air conditioner.
I know it. What
oh,
were we
my
thinking?
Gosh.
Man, that
That's
was...
what I want to know. In Texas in the summer?
That's not an option. How did we survive?
I don't know how we made it. I really don't.
I don't either.
And I remember when you'd look up there and it right below the steering wheel, it'd have drive, park, neutral. And you'd pull that handle, and it showed it in red. you know, whichever place you were on. I remember that so well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then it was the same time when to affect your bright lights, you'd have that little button on the floor that you would click with your foot to turn your brights on and off.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yes. You had to push the little button with your foot. To go to bright. Yes. Wow.
Yeah. I remember I got fooled for a long time. My dad would drive around in the car and he would turn the lights on and I would watch his hands and I'm like, how are you doing that? And he's like, oh, it's magic. And then I finally figured it out. But it took a long time. I'm like, I don't understand.
To figure out he was doing it with his foot.
Yeah. The good old days.
Yeah. The good old days. We've come a long way.
We really
are. We're all spoiled now.
We really are. My goodness. You know, all the gadgets that we have and all the modern conveniences we have. I mean, my goodness. Sometimes our vehicles are more equipped and more livable than our homes. It's crazy what's inside cars now.
Well, the engineers are so brilliant now. The engineers have brought us a long, long way.
Yeah.
You know, if we go back 10 or 20 years, it's not even the same engineering.
Oh, no. No, no. Man, even like the materials that vehicles are made out of. I remember, you know, one of my first cars was a Gran Torino, and that thing was it was a tank. It was steel. The tires were, I mean, you could have put the tires on a tank, and you could have driven anywhere at any time. And so even, you know, all the stuff that makes them lighter, it's fascinating just the technology that goes into these things. And the engineer.
Do you realize now there's so much plastic in cars? It's not the same cars.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, used to everything was steel, like you said. All the frame had to be steel. But now there's a lot of plastic in every car.
Yeah, plastic. What was it? Many years ago, one of the first things that they did was they started making fiberglass cars. And I had heard it was one of really teeny tiny ones. What was it? Was it a Fiero or... So I think it was a Pontiac something, but if you got into an accident, they would basically disintegrate. The material would, and so I'm like, that's a little dangerous.
Oh yeah, that's what you nearly need.
Yeah,
I mean the insurance companies didn't want any part of that.
Oh no.
Yeah, because they were going to have to pay off big time.
Yeah, man, but. Gosh, I mean, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of plastic and a lot of different materials, and it's neat in a lot of ways what they've done, because cars were so
heavy.
Yeah,
it is, because they've learned to build things a lot lighter. You know, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, and then you know, like the lighter the car is, the better your gas mileage is, and so it's all these things are so intertwined. I don't even know, you know, back in the 70s, I could have never even imagined half of the things that we have now, and now we can't imagine living without them.
That's right. We couldn't do without all these fancy things.
Yeah.
We wouldn't know how to act, would we?
We would not. This is Your Money with Faye Bagby. Your phone number is?
It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. Our website is AmericanFinancialMidland.com.
So here we are. We're well into the new year now. We're into what, the third week of January, and so you know, kind of everything's getting back to normal. What are some of the big highlights? How are we starting the year 2022? Are we on a good note?
Well, we're bidding a lot of policies. We've turned down three already this week.
Really?
I hated to turn them down, but they were good policies, except the premium was really, really high.
Oh.
And I said, we just can't do that. I mean, you know, we've got that 3% stop, and that's what we need to stay with. So I didn't do it, even though one of them was pancreatic cancer.
Really?
And we know it's a good policy, but the premiums were huge on it.
Mm.
So we had to turn it down. We turned down three. We bought one, turned down three. So I'll be looking at some more. This next week and see what we can come up with.
How many do you normally look at on an average week? How many come across your desk?
Oh, maybe five, six.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting that, you turned down a pancreatic cancer one, because I know how we talk about all
That's
the time.
That's right. We didn't want to.
Yeah.
We did not want to.
Man.
I figured it every way in the world. And let me tell you something. If that thing goes over, I believe they'd tar and feather me.
It would have been...
I think I would if it was me.
It'd have been trouble.
Man. It would have been trouble in River City because it was just too high.
Yeah.
I don't know why these particular policies were so high, but they were. So we just said, you know, there ain't any way we can do it.
Wow. That's strange, because that's one of the the ones that that most
that's
people
our
love.
Backbone, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, we love pancreatic cancer. We do them all the time. And ours have always been, you know, 2%, 2.5%, something like that. This was like 6%.
Ooh, wow. That's what why was it so high?
I don't know. When they bought it, they just didn't do a good job buying their insurance.
Wow.
They should have I just can't imagine somebody buying a policy that had that kind of premium. They didn't shop their policy good enough. If they'd shopped it, they could have come up, I know, with something better than that, because they were not elderly, so it shouldn't be that high on a normal person. But it was really, really high.
Wow. It's interesting that you go through, because I know you go through all of them, you know, with a fine-tooth comb a number of times, and so you really analyze these things before you even, you know, consider bidding on them. And so for that to come across your desk, I would think probably your first reaction is like, oh, wow, this is going to be a great policy. And then you start getting in there, and it's just like, uh-oh, there's some red flags that are starting to show up here. And so, man, that would have been a really good one, because I know they're so...
Yes, it would have. And the other two were really good, but the premiums were prohibitive. One was 17%.
What? Really?
Yeah. I've never even heard of one that high. I'd never even seen one that high. And whoever helped these guys with their insurance did not do them any favors, because they were way, way out of line. And they're good insurance companies. They weren't anybody that we wouldn't want to do business with. It's just that they... bought a policy, and they paid way too much.
Wow.
So I don't know who'll buy it. I know our brokers were mad at us because we turned them down, because they know we always buy those, and they were not happy yesterday when we said, we're sorry, we're going to turn those down.
Well, surely they understood why. I mean, my gosh.
Let them put it on somebody else.
Yeah.
Let somebody else take that risk, but not us.
Wow, I mean, your whole point is to you know, make money and find, you know, policies that will generate a good return for people, not just to, you know, take something where that's the whole point. I don't understand. I've never even heard of anything even 17%. I didn't even know that was possible.
I never had either.
Wow,
it was 17%, and that. That's 179,000 on this policy. $179,000.
Wow.
I don't know. I just don't know of anybody that's going to do that.
Man, somebody got somebody good at some point.
They did. They really put it to them.
Wow.
And this poor guy's got cancer. Now he's stuck.
Oh, man. I don't even know if anybody.
He's
going to
pay that himself.
Yeah.
No. And I hope he's got a lot of money, because he's going to need it. Can you imagine? In 3 years?
No.
He's going to be at $600,000. That's terrible.
Wow. Man.
Yeah.
That was a raw deal on his part. I feel bad for that.
Yeah, really, really bad. I felt for him. But we just said, we're sorry. We can't take that kind of risk.
I don't blame you.
I mean,
you on
the 5% almost did me under when I saw 5%.
Yeah.
I go, oh, my gosh, that's $5,000 on 100.
Man.
And you know, people don't want to pay that, and I don't want them to. You know, if it's 3% or less, we'll buy. And we like for it to be 0.5%, 0.25%. We buy a lot of them that way. And we just don't need anything that's real high. It makes our risk so high that there's no use doing it.
3% is about the limit? Is that like about the...
Yes, we try to limit to that. We've done two... over the years that had higher ones, but we put our biggest customers in it, and they took the risk willingly because they knew it was going to come due real quick. And I told them at the time, I said, you know, your premium is going to be $25,000.
Man.
They had enough faith in it. They did it, and they came out without paying a dime.
Wow. What was it about that?
That was a risk, a big risk.
Yeah, because that's really outside the realm. What was
it? Oh, yeah, that's outside our bailiwick altogether. And we like for it to be 2% or less is really favorable, 2% or less.
When you looked at that big one, what was it that said, you know, this might be worth taking the gamble for this particular policy? What was it about that was so that made you go ahead and do that?
Well, it was showing that he didn't have long to live and that it was terminal. And we took that risk, and he really was terminal.
So there was literally no way out, nothing.
No, there was no way out for him.
Wow.
And but we still had to sweat it. And sure enough, he came in early, and nobody got caught. But it was a risk, let's put it that way.
Wow. So I would imagine it's probably one of those things where you have your rules, but then every once in a while you have enough experience and you've done this long enough that you know when to break those rules in certain cases, though. I would imagine that would have been one of those times.
That's right. So it's case by case. If it looks like it's something that's going to work, if we don't have a lot of risk, we'll take it. But if it's got too much risk, we're going to pass. There's no use worrying ourselves to death, you know. And if you don't have a high premium, you're not going to have the risk. So you're not going to worry about it. You're going to know nature will take its course. The person's going to die, early, on time, or a little late, and we can stand it. So we just have to take that precaution.
You know, it's just kind of dawned on me while you were while you were saying that it's interesting and cool at the same time that when you look at these policies, you don't just kind of like, you know, put them in an automated machine, push a button, and if it falls within a certain range, you'll take it, and if not, you won't. You look at every single policy, no matter what it says on the top, no matter what it's labeled as, no matter, you know, you still go through every single one as though it is the only policy that you have to go through, and you go through them with a fine-tooth comb, and you don't just kind of like lump things in. This is, well, this is, you know, pancreatic cancer, for example, so we're going to take it, or this is a, you know, certain kind that particularly usually might pass on, and you say, well, we're going to pass on it. You know, there's certain situations, I guess, for each individual policy, and it's interesting to see how those kind of play out when you go through them, you know, with a fine-tooth comb like that, and you take those rare risks and they pay off. So it's kind of neat that you don't just kind of like lump them all into one general pile.
Well, you can't, because like on these, we got look at the cancer medication. What kind of cancer medication are they on? Are they on end of life? There's some cancer that have end of life treatments, and it's called maintenance. But what it really means is if you're on that, you've got about 8 months. So we looked that up to see which one they're on. Because that one, so far, if they're taking that, the average life expectancy is 8 months.
Wow.
So you have to know all that, which cancer drugs, you know, are end of life, which ones are a maintenance, which ones are going to prolong it. If you study all that, it'll really help.
So when you see these policies come in, does it say in there, we're just trying to make this person comfortable, or are you like looking at the drug names and you just know what they mean?
We're looking at all the drug names, which ones are switching to, which ones are on, if they're on hydrochloride, if they're on hydrocodone, you know, it depends what pain medicine they're on also. If they're in a lot of pain, you know it's really bad. If they're not on any pain medicine, they're not very sick.
Wow.
Because cancer is something that the pain is horrific. And everybody has it knows that. So if they're not giving you pain medication, if it's not a 10, you know, you're probably not that sick.
Yeah. I know we talk a lot about, you know, like when you look at them and see like their lifestyle, if they're out playing golf, you know, they're probably, you know, doing all right. But if they're not, you know, I know you say all the time that you look at the medicine and the treatments that they're on, but we haven't really taken a deep dive into it. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, the different types of drugs mean different stages in their treatment or how it's progressing.
That's right. And if the ones stay with traditional medicine, they're going to live longer. That's what those medicines are for. But people go to Mexico. They go to Europe. They try to beat the system. They believe that all this medicine is bad for them. We know it's bad, but it's better than death, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we're trying to save them. Instead, they go to Mexico. They do all this outlandish stuff. They come back. And they're not going to live any time once they've tried that different type of treatment rather than traditional. And I would just tell them all the time, don't do it. Your life is worth more than that.
Yeah. When people do these alternative treatments like that, by the time they decide to sell their policy, is it pretty much, and I know this is kind of general and it may not apply to everybody, but generally speaking, is it at that point too late for them by the time they try to sell their policy?
Well, I think that it's not going to go well. That's what I can tell you. They've tried all this over-the-top stuff. They come back. They go to the doctor, and he says, well, now it's advanced. It's so advanced, we can't do anything about it. You know, but when they leave, you know, they're telling them, okay, it's stage four. You know, here's what we can do. We can remove the breast. We can do this. We can do radiation. We can do chemo. They don't want to mess up their body. What's worth more, the breast or your whole body?
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. They make that bad decision.
Yeah.
And men are not as vain as women. If they tell a man, you've got prostate cancer, this is what we need to do, most of them will do it.
Yeah.
And try to save their life. But women are not that way.
It's a scary thing to go through, that's for sure.
It is, and we feel for them all the way because we know how painful, how there's days they just curl up, they can't function. We know all that, but we don't have an alternate in this country. We don't have a drug that's not going to make them sick. We don't have something that's going to make them just feel better, you know?
Wow.
So, you know, everybody's doing the best they can. But I would certainly recommend staying with, you know, just the regular medication. And, you know, we lost a client 2 months ago to brain cancer.
Oh,
he had no idea he had it.
Really?
I mean, no, he had no idea.
I didn't know.
He was having headaches, a few other things. He went to have it operated on to see, and he didn't even make it through it.
Oh, my goodness.
So.
Wow, I'm so
sorry. If you're having all these symptoms, you know, you should go to the doctor, go to a specialist, get a second opinion.
Yeah.
A lot
of times, you know, you hear people that you know, they'll say, well, I've got these symptoms. And, you know, there's always kind of like when we Google medical things, it can be a disaster because a lot of times, you know, people will Google something and they may have a simple cold. But if you look for something online or try to self-diagnose, a lot of times we have, you know, a much worse diagnosis than what it actually is. And then on the other hand, you know, a lot of times we can just write off, well, you know, simple headache, you know, it might be just, you know, stress or, you know, some kind of a, you know, something else may be going on or, you know, we just, a lot of times symptoms can be, you know, explained some other way. And so by the time we have things checked, it's oftentimes too late. So it's a difficult place to be in, especially when, you know, you put things off and then find out that it actually is something serious.
Well, and remember, we have Dallas and we have Houston that has, you know, some of the best medical anywhere. UT Southwestern, you know, has every facility in the world. MD Anderson in Houston, you know, they have really good facilities. And all these big hospitals are on cutting edge, you know, trying to get something done.
Yeah.
And you can go to these little bitty towns. And I know we have good doctors in small towns. But a case in point, in Denton, Texas, this lady was having lung problems. She went to this doctor. Oh, he said, it's nothing. You're going to be all right. She goes to a different specialist. And they said, lady, you've got stage 4 lung cancer.
What? Really?
Yeah. And so if somebody gives you an opinion and you still feel really bad, you need to go to somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, go get that second opinion always.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that.
It could save your life.
Literally. Totally. Yeah. And so.
Yes.
You know, by the time people, you know, go through this situation, I'm sure when they're selling their policy, they're in a place where it's like, you know, we've tried everything we can. We've exhausted all of the efforts within a normal realm. And now we're starting to look for, you know, other, you know, I guess selling their policy is not the first thing that people normally do, is it? Or maybe it is. Or it seems like it would be like further down the line.
The first thing they do is they go to the cancer specialist. After their doctor sends them to one, then they find out how much it's going to cost. It's going to take everything they've got. They're going to go bankrupt if they don't sell their policies. So whatever policy they have available, they're going to call in. They're going to say, I need to sell this policy. What can I get for it? And they're going to shop it. People are sophisticated. They shop these policies, and they're trying to get the best price they can. But what they should do is start with one broker. Go to that one broker, let him handle it. But a lot of times people don't know that, and they'll go and shop it themselves. And before they're through, they're not probably going to get the best deal. Because you've got the people that pay 28 cents on the dollar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It
seems like, and I might be misremembering things, so please correct me, because I'm sure I don't have this accurate, but it seems like at one point we had talked about how some brokers are not out for their client's best interest. They will, you know, get really high fees or, you know, outrageous, you know, they'll sell it to, like you said, 28 cents on the dollar. Are there some dishonest brokers?
Yeah, that's all they'll give them. And we know it. Because we get a report all the time. This is what the policy sold for this year. This is how much the brokers are paying. So we know what the brokers are paying. We know the ones that are paying 28, 29 cents. And the people we deal with, we're paying them a lot more than that. We're paying like 70 cents on the dollar.
Oh, really?
You know, And then our clients are getting as much as we can possibly give. We're not like a mutual fund, you know, they're guaranteeing like 8 or 6%, and those policies aren't even going to come due for 5-7 years. So we're staying away from that. We're not going to do that. We're trying to do mostly IRAs, people that are going to retire, so they're going to have some money. So we've got to think about that as we do it. You know, what will make them the most money? How soon will it come due? And what are their protections on it? So that's what we're working at on all the time.
How's the bidding competition right now? And with these, like the roughly the 70 cents on the dollar figure in mind, does the competition, like how dense it is, does that affect that number? Because I know you've got to maintain your profit margin, but if competition is a little bit higher and it's a little bit more competitive kind of a market, how does that affect?
Well, competition is always pretty brisk, and right now it's brisk. It's first of the year. Everybody wants these policies. You know, we had a 15-month. We bid hard on it. We did not get it, but we're trying. You know, we're bidding every day. There's some good ones out there. We'll get our share, and you know, we'll invest the money as quickly as we can.
Do you compromise? But that might be the wrong word. But when you're trying to bid on policies and you're trying to like outbid somebody else, and you're looking at the profit margin, does that line move? Is it adjustable, or do you hit a line where it's like?
Oh yeah, it does move because we're going to try to get it. We're going to try to bid it as close as we can. We'll get it for the clients without the clients suffering any, where they'll still make their profit.
Hmm. So you're still weighing the price that you'll pay for the policy and their profit margin, and then you're still looking at competitors trying to outbid them while satisfying all these things at the same time. It seems like a lot of things to juggle all at once, I would think.
It is. It's a lot. It is, because you've got to look at the LA. You've got to see what the premium is. You've got to see if it's a convertible. Is it fixed? Can it be redone? You've got to look at all that as you do it and see if the premium's going to go up, or are they going to stay steady for the next 10 years, or can we change it where we know it'll be fixed rate? So all that is real important.
So when you're looking at these, is it fair to say, and I may not be even characterizing this the right way, but is it fair to say that if you're looking at a policy and maybe the competition on a policy is particularly heavy, but maybe you'll look at it and you'll say, you know, the premiums are a little bit higher, but we think it's worth it because they're on this drug, they're on this drug, they're on this, or they've been through that, or is that a fair way to kind of judge how the markers kind of move a little bit based on all those factors?
Right. It's on a lot of factors affects the policy. Everything in the world affects it. What the premium is, the age, that's another thing. You know, we don't do over 75. We try not to do anybody over 75. Survivors are 50 years old that have cancer. Sometimes they're 60. But anyway, we're looking at all the factors on the policy. You know, how long do we have? Is it going to be steady for 10 years, 5 years? Has it already been converted? You know, we're going to study everything about it.
Wow. Just to ensure that you maintain that profit margin, because that's really what it's all about. There's a ton of companies that will buy policies. So if you bypass one and say, you know, the profit margin just isn't there, the risk is too big, we're just going to pass on this one. There are a ton of other companies that will buy policies like that. So it's not like you're doing anybody a disservice. You're just keeping an eye out for your clients and making sure that they can actually get into a profitable investment, right?
That's exactly right. We've got to keep the profit up for the client. If we have to discount, we'll do it. We're going to do whatever it takes to try to get the best policy for the clients, because it's their money. Always remember that. It's the client's money you're dealing with. We have a fiduciary responsibility to do the best that we can for them at all times.
And that's really what it's all about. This is Your Money with Fay Bagby, and your phone number is
877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. Our website is AmericanFinancialMidland.com.
And every Saturday morning, we pause from all the numbers and the math and the business, and we take a little break and do some trivia. So what is our topic this morning?
You're going to be shocked. Uh-huh. It's about the Green Hornet's car.
Really?
Now, you would never think I would have come up with this in your wildest imagination.
No, that would have been the last thing I would have guessed.
I know. You said, what if she lost her mind? Well, let me tell you something. I got to think about the cartoons of years ago. Mm. Now, when you do a cartoon on paper, you can make it do anything, right?
Oh, yeah.
It can tear up the world. So, anyway, I got to thinking about this. And the Green Hornet cars are so famous, I decided to depart from Texas trivia this morning to do this. So, because it was so interesting to me. Now, this was a 1966 television show, if you remember, mm-hmm. The Green Hornet. Now, most people don't know how that came about. This car was a Crown Imperial. I don't know if you remember that.
Okay. It's vague because it was a long time ago, but yeah, I'm on board.
Okay. It was modified. It was low to the ground. It had tinted windows, green headlights, hot rod wheeled. But there's no mistake. This was a high-profile car. Now, here's what they did. They said, we've got to have 28 of these from 1964 to 66. They needed two hero cars that had to be pristine, with fully functioning, and they could not be used by the stunt department. They had some cars had no motors.
Really?
Yeah. The final chase sequence, the car goes through various degrees of destruction. So they had to have all these cars for each degree of damage.
Oh, wow.
So the hunt took them from San Diego to Canada.
Really?
Most of the cars were in terrible shape. Had rust. So they stripped them to the frames and added Chevrolet V8 engines, a Race Trans Turbo 400 transmissions, four differentials, and four-wheel disc brakes. The body parts for the 1965 Crown Imperial are no longer even manufactured. So the guy got the pieces from an unlikely source. He found an eccentric 80-year-old guy in Washington who had a whole collection of Imperials. And the guy would not part with them. He said, "No, I'm not going to give you any of my complete cars. I'll sell you some parts." So they had parts for 28 cars.
Really?
So then the stunt department had to add everything. And I don't know if you even remember. They had weapons. They had machine guns mounted on. They had missiles. They had a flamethrower.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is on a real car.
Wow.
And they rebuilt 15 of these cars. Now, the Black Beauty was an Imperial, but only on the outside. Underneath, it was a complete race car.
Really?
And they wrecked all 26 cars. Only three survived. And that took a big chunk out of the remaining Imperials on the whole planet. They said, "How are we going to find 25 more cars after they just destroyed 28 of them?"
Man.
In a television series. But can you imagine, they had 30 caliber machine guns mounted on the front. They had flamethrowers underneath. They had 12 front and rear end Stinger missiles on the front.
Wow.
They had a ballistic steel reinforced exterior. It was 4.6 milligram of steel on the sides of that car.
My God.
They had spikes in all the tires.
Really?
Now this, I mean, this thing was really made to go. And most people didn't even know all this, that this was the coolest car in town. And it was just a Chrysler Imperial on the outside. But on the inside, this car was one of a kind. It's just an amazing deal. And then, of course, as I said, some of them didn't even have a motor out of those 28 cars. And then the stunt department, they were the ones that put the weapons, the machine guns, the missiles, flamethrowers. And so then they had to go out and find 26 more. And there wasn't even any complete cars left by then of the Imperial, because this was a long time ago. And they were rebuilding cars. They spent $50,000 on two Imperials that were going to be the ones that everybody could see all the time.
Like the show
cars. And the guy gave them 30 days. Yeah, the show car. He only gave them 30 days.
Really?
Yeah.
Man.
And so when the Green Hornet said rigged for silent running, nobody knows this, they would turn it off, and the listener was left to imagine that the car really was silent. But what it was, they removed the soundtrack from the command. And that's how they accomplished that.
Wow.
And they had the infra-green headlights, and they were not actually rigged to flip. So they had green filters that deployed constantly. And they used polarized lights and polarized vision filters and a green sun visor that could be pulled down. But these cars were an amazing feat, and to spend $50,000 a car on the ones that were going to show up is an amazing thing to me. That and this was such a success, but it only lasted a short time, as you know. The Green Hornet wasn't on very long.
No.
But
wow.
The stunts that they were able to do with this car is just a feat. I mean, can you imagine? And so the guy later said, "I want to buy this." Well, they were having a fight over it. And he finally got the car, the real Black Beauty. He restored it to its current condition. And the rocket the only problem was the rocket launchers on the trunk lid had been sealed. That's the only thing he couldn't get undone. It was welded shut. And he would have had to replace the whole body panel in order to make the system functional again. Everything else was intact. He spent all this money. He paid $10,000 to get the car after the series ended.
Really?
Yeah. And, of course, it's now in a museum.
Oh, wow. I'd like to go see that. Man,
yes,
that'd be cool.
It's in the Turner Museum. It's really a cool, cool car. Even though it says Chrysler Imperial, it's anything but a Chrysler Imperial underneath. It's a heck of a race car.
Wow.
And they said it would go 200 miles an hour way back then.
Really?
Yeah. And these engineers, he only gave them 30 days to build these two cars. That's identical.
That's almost impossible.
Yeah. And when you look at it, the front of the Chrysler Imperial Black Beauty doesn't even look like a Chrysler to me.
Oh, no. You'd have no idea.
No.
But
it was something else. And you know who drove it, don't you?
Huh.
Cato, who was Bruce Lee.
Oh.
You don't remember that? Bruce Lee was Cato in the old Green Hornet.
It's one of those things where it's like, you know, I remember watching it. It's just all some of the details. I just they slip my mind. I do the same thing with like the old Batman series from the 60s.
Yeah.
I remember it, but there's bits and pieces.
Of course, it started out as a cartoon, and then when they brought it to television, it had to be for real. But it took 28 cars each time in different dresses, you would call it. As they tore them all up on the set.
Yeah, I can't believe that they destroyed that many and then had to go find 25 more to replace them when they already had enough trouble finding the original stock of them.
And then this old man, he was 80 years old, he said, I'll sell you parts, but I'm not ever going to save the whole car.
Wow. Man.
Yeah, so it was really amazing to me. That it had rocket launchers on it.
Yeah, and these were all real things on a real car.
Yes, flamethrowers. It had everything in the world, and you can see them on the car. The 30 caliber machine guns show up very well. I mean, they're very. You can see, and then Stinger missiles. I mean, what the heck? This is in the 60s.
Yeah. It seems almost kind of like ahead of its time.
I think it was way ahead of its time. Whoever was drawing it originally, you know, thought all this up, and then they had to make it real after they'd done all this.
Yeah, and the weird thing is that, you know, to imagine these things, it's one thing, you know, because, you know, well, this is never going to go any further than, you know, a drawing or something like that.
Yeah.
And then to have to actually make it in real life, you know, without like, you know, because that was back before you had, you know, all your special effects and, you know, we'll just, you know, put this in here or we'll just, you know, insert in post-production, we'll put in a machine gun or a flamethrower or something like that. We'll just add that later with special effects.
Yeah.
But to have to actually do it in real life and to do it in that short of amount of time, it's quite fascinating when you stop and think about it. It's really it's amazing that they got all that stuff done, and it looks so amazing and it's so believable.
Yeah, and he told them, he said, you've got 30 days, $50,000 for each car.
Wow.
And they took those two cars and remade them, put all this in. And of course, they never let the stunt department touch them.
Of course,
I guess they figured they would destroy them. You know,
and clearly.
But I thought that was so interesting that that back then you could have somebody build these cars with machine guns and everything, and missiles, everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also kind of fascinating how they had different ones for different stages of the destruction scenes.
That's right.
I didn't know
and
that was a thing.
Some of them didn't even have motors in them. Some of them was just the body, and you saw it and you see it get hit, and you saw all that happen. But each one was in a different part of the movie, and it had to serve for a different part. So it took 28 during the movie.
Wow.
In different parts to make it work.
Fascinating.
Without destroying these other two.
Yeah.
I'm sure the stunt department would have destroyed him in about 5 minutes.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's like, these are the show vehicles. Do not destroy them. Do not put fingerprints on them. Do not breathe on these vehicles. These stay intact.
That's right. They were saying, you stay away from this.
Yeah.
This does not go to the stunt department. But I was amazed that this guy had this much faith to build them like this and spend all this money. $50,000 for each car was a lot of money in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Man, that was a fortune.
Yeah, I mean, this guy was spending a fortune getting these cars rigged up. And they said after that, a lot of people did a lot of these different cars, but nothing like this one.
Yeah.
So that was an amazing deal. And then it went to the museum, and that's where it is now.
I really want to go see that, too. I think that would be really, really cool, especially now knowing the story behind it and how fascinating
that is. Yeah, knowing how it got there.
Yes.
How it was built. And, of course, that one part was welded down, and they couldn't get that back out. But the rest of it, you know, they put it right back like it was, and I don't know what he spent redoing it after he bought it, but he restored it completely. So it is an amazing story. And we never think about the stunt people or the people that make all these crazy movies, how they do it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. To figure out how to take, you know, this is a drawing, this is a fantasy, and then to have to actually make it so that it's a real life, totally different concept. Because a lot of times the things that are in drawings, especially with, you know, like superheroes and comics and, you know, things like that, it's like they're not, they physically would not work. Just because of simple physics, sometimes, or simple engineering.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff, you could not make it real if you had to.
Yeah.
But this one was actually real because it was cars. I would like to go see it also. I think it's an amazing story.
Yeah, that really is fascinating. This is Your Money with Faye Bagby. Your phone number is?
It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. 3330. And our website is AmericanFinancialMidland.com.
You know, I saw something that kind of reminds me here. I think it was on Instagram a week or two ago. I saw something about the how they did something similar with like the Batmobile, and they showed the original vehicle that it started out as. I think it was a Ford something. I can't remember exactly what. But then they showed like the different stages and what they had to do to modify it to make it, you know, make it into the Batmobile for the series in the 60s. So it's really quite fascinating what they can do. It's amazing.
Yeah, and now everything is so technical. You know, you have to have engineers to engineer all this, to do all this for them.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so let's get into some of the risks with a life settlement. I know that, you know, you already look at the policies themselves to make sure that they're profitable for people. So before it even gets to anybody's email, you've already gone through it, and so you've kind of eliminated, you know, all the non-profitable policies. You've taken those out. But then on top of that, once people get into it, there are three major risks. What is the first biggest one?
The first and your largest risk is it can go over and you're going to have to pay premiums. So that is your biggest risk, hands down, is if it goes over, it means you will have to pay premiums until the person dies. So that's your first risk. Your second risk is it is not liquid until it matures. When that person passes away, it becomes liquid, and then you can do whatever you want to. And when people pass away, then we send and get a death certificate. Then it goes to the carrier, and the insurance company pays you. And it goes into your account every time. And that is done by Nevada Trust. And then the third risk is if a life insurance company ever went under. We haven't had one go under in years. They're all worth so much money now, it doesn't even hardly need to talk about it, because they are worth billions and billions. And used to, they were worth millions, and now they're worth billions.
With a B.
Yes, with a B.
When people are looking at the risks that you talk about, it almost seems like, okay, those are understood. We got it. You know, it makes all the sense in the world. But it kind of puts a little bit of a different perspective on it when you know that you've got to even be accredited in order to do it. It kind of like lessens them a little bit because it's not like you're down to your last $12 and, you know, you're going to need to be able to access it, or cash it out or something like that, knowing that it's not liquid. For example, it's not going to really affect people. So what does it mean to be accredited? What are the qualifications?
Okay, you have to make either $200,000 a year or you need to be worth $1 million without your home. That is a government stipulation, not from me, but from the government. So you have to make $200,000 a year to invest with us, or you must be worth $1 million without your home. And our minimum investment is $100,000.
And that just applies to life settlements, right? Not like annuities or anything else.
Yes, that's just your life settlements.
So if somebody's not
and
accredited.
Annuities are a little different. If they're not accredited, they can do annuities. I highly recommend annuities. We have a whole slew of people that have taken out annuities over the years. It's paid them well. They simply say every year, I need to make a draw, and they take 10% out every year. Their money has lasted a long, long time, I'll tell you.
And that's a good option for people as well. Not only for people who are not accredited, but I would imagine probably you have people who are diversified, who do some life settlements and probably some annuities. Is that pretty accurate?
Yes, that's right. And you can do both. You can have annuities. You can have life settlements. It's what you're comfortable with.
Are people when they're kind of weighing the two? And this might be not even a thing. I have a feeling that's probably what you're going to tell me. That's not a thing. But when they look at these and kind of deciding, okay, I want to say somebody's accredited. Say they're looking at life settlements versus annuities. Is there one of them that people will say, you know, which one, you know, gets me the biggest return the fastest? Or is there?
That would be life settlements. Is going to make you money faster than an annuity. But annuity is tried and true. It just works every year. It's like a plow horse. It just works. It goes on working every year.
Do you?
And it always pays you.
Do you prefer one over the other? It may just depend on goals.
I think they're both different. For each person, it's a different thing for each person.
All right.
If it's somebody that's in their 70s, they may want to stick with annuities and not have to worry about anything. Just every year you get a check, every year. But then a lot of people, they want the advantage of the higher rates. And if you're looking for the higher rates, then you're going to go to life settlements.
Really?
So it depends which way you're going, yes.
Wow, I almost would have thought for some reason that you would have said like the opposite, that people in their 70s might be more attracted to a life settlement because...
No, I think they should be attracted more to annuity.
Wow, okay. What's the greatest... Because I know for each one, they both have their pros and cons, but for annuities, what is the greatest draw for most people? What's the thing that you hear that people want that?
You know that your principal is guaranteed. You can do a guaranteed interest rate, or you can have an index, which mimics the stock market. It's not directly ever in the stock market, but it mimics it. There's some great advantages to annuities. As I said, you can take 10% a year out, or you can take a lump sum at the end of 10 years. Or 7 years, you can say, I just want to keep my interest in there every year, and then I'll just cash it out. You can do that.
So there's options.
A lot of options, yes.
for a life settlement, what would be the greatest aspect of that? Because I know there's a lot of perks for a life settlement. You know, you've got the stability, you've got the fact that it's not related to the stock market or world events. There's the quicker returns, especially with the policies that you're buying. You know, you're looking at 30 months on average, you know, is kind of like the limit, not like 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So what would be the greatest draw for most people with a life settlement?
The rate of return, I think, because it has a great rate of return on all the ones we do. Did you know I added up this week to see how many policies we have? We have $89 million in policies.
Whoa, really?
$89 million.
Good Lord. I had no idea.
So
I knew
people have got a lot of money coming to them.
Wow.
Over the next 2 or 3 years, yes.
Man. Okay, and it is worth pointing out that when people do life settlements, because I know that, you know, now we're into the new year, people are probably going through that assessment phase where they're thinking, you know, I really enjoy time off during the holidays. You know, the economy is changing, things are going on, you know, at work. I really want to sell my business, or, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, I've been at the same job for, you know, 30 years. I want to retire. People are kind of going through that phase right now where they're, you know, kind of reassessing things, and they're saying, you know, what are my options? I kind of want to get out of the stock market. It's so unstable. It's unsure, you know, and so people are looking at things. And so when they look at the life settlement, probably I'm guessing one of the things that they should know is that whatever does happen in the world doesn't affect it. So if war breaks out in the Ukraine or something happens in the economy and there's a crash or something happens, their life settlement investment is fully intact, right?
That's exactly right. It doesn't have the ups and downs of the stock market. And I see the ups and downs of the stock market in living color every day.
Yeah.
And I see that a lot of people have taken their money out of the stock market. They've got to the sidelines because they're worried. And a lot of people, they don't even know to worry. So, you know, it depends which school you're in. You know, I know some people just don't even know to worry. Then I've got other people. You know, that say, I'm getting out. You know, I don't want to take the risk in case something does happen.
All right. What's the outlook?
So, I think the outlook is we're going to write a lot of policies this year. We're going to have a lot of maturities this year. We're going to make people a lot of profit. That's my goal. My goal is to make a profitable year for the clients.
And it's been a really good start so far in 2022. So
yes.
To get started, for somebody who's thinking about, you know, maybe taking on life settlements, maybe taking a change, maybe getting out of the stock market, if they're in that place, they're thinking about it, what should they do before they come in and talk to you?
They should make sure that they make either $200,000 or that they have $1 million net worth without the house, and then call me, go over it with me, talk to me about it, and see if this is what you want to do.
Okay. So for appointment availability, I assume you've got appointments available this coming week, yes?
That's right. We're ready to help people.
Awesome. All right, Faye, one last time for people to call and get started, get some information, get the ball rolling. What is your number for them to call?
It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. Our website, AmericanFinancialMidland.com. Go there. There's a lot of information. Look us over.
You've been listening to Your Money with Faye Bagby. Sound advice to help your money grow. Listen for Your Money with Faye Bagby every Saturday morning at 10 here on 97 Gold. This program has been a paid presentation for American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC, and has been brought to you by American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC. The opinions expressed on the program by the host, host guest, and call-in listeners are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not represent the opinions of management of this station or Brazos Communications West, LLC, who bear no responsibility or liability for the program's content. The purpose of this radio program is intended to inform the public on financial planning issues and investment products for qualified individuals and investors. Many of the topics and opinions discussed may be of a personal nature, and some people may disagree with or find opinions expressed on this program objectionable. Before you invest, you should consult with financial advisors and review the program prospectus and its risks.